All right, so I'm going to talk about, give you an overview, or try to give you an overview of neutrinos and supernovae, core collapse supernovae in particular. And I'm going to try to emphasize essentially just the basic physics of supernovae and the basic physics of neutrinos and how they overlap. And subsequent speakers, Yong Chen later will talk about the R process in neutrinos and supernovae. And I think Cecilia Leonardini will talk about the supernova neutrino signal. And Christian Cardall, I think, will talk about the supernova mechanism in far more detail than I'll go into here. So this talk is an overview that will emphasize, hopefully, just the basic physics at a somewhat superficial level. In some sense, core collapse supernovae are the ultimate neutrino physics laboratories. You hear that all the time. Problem is that no one has bothered to give us the key to the laboratory door. There are many issues with supernovae. Core collapse supernovae, we don't really understand why they explode, or at least some of them explode, some core collapse events explode. There's an issue with heavy element nucleus synthesis. They're the prime suspects in the production of heavy nuclei like iodine, uranium, and gold, but we don't really know in detail how that comes about. In fact, there are problems with it. If we can ever detect the neutrino signal from supernovae, then that could tell us potentially a lot, both about how these other things, the explosion and nucleus synthesis, come about, and also potentially about interesting aspects of neutrino physics that we can't otherwise know, for example, theta-1-3, or whether there are heavier sterile states that mix with the active neutrinos. So neutrinos are likely responsible in one way or another for the explosions in the nucleus synthesis associated with these events, and we'll talk about that, and subsequent speakers will talk about that. We have to say right off the bat that we don't really understand in detail how explosions come about. How viable shocks are generated associated with the collapse of the core of a massive star. We know that somehow nature manages to do it, but we don't really know in detail how it's done. However, as we'll outline here, there's a huge amount, essentially all the neutrino energy, is like whoever it was that said, you know, why do you rob banks? And the answer was that, well, that's where the money is. Well, all of the energy, or a huge amount of energy, something like 10% of the rest mass of the neutron star core of this thing, is in the neutrino seeds that are trapped in the core and diffuse out on a time scale of order seconds. Okay? So many attempts to understand the explosion have centered on neutrino heating of the material both above and below the shock that's generated by the initial bounce of the core when it falls in, and also neutrino-driven, in two- and three-dimensional hydrodynamic models, neutrino-driven convective transport of this energy, of this neutrino energy, from somewhere near the neutron star surface or just below it to somewhere in the vicinity of the shock. Now, since neutrino flavors may have quite different energy spectra at certain times, as one thing that's important to realize is there's no one event here. Actually, there's quite a long time scale of something of order 10 seconds, where, and maybe even 20 seconds, where lots of interesting things are happening. And we need to know really what the neutrino energy spectra are over that whole range of time. So you might hear somebody tell you that, oh, well, the neutrino energy spectra are all the same at this time. That may be true. In fact, one issue is we don't really know the neutrino opacities and the equation of state issues associated with opacity well enough to confidently predict what the neutrino energy spectra will be. It may be that the neutrino energies are close together and very similar. The spectra is similar at one time, and likely that means they're different at some other time. Okay? That's an important thing to keep in mind. But if they are different, to the extent that they're different, and different flavors of neutrinos have different energy spectra, then that's where neutrino physics gets its purchase on this problem. Because neutrino mixing, matter-enhanced flavor transformation, can change the flavors. Okay, well, the flavors will preserve their energies if they change. And it's by that matter-enhanced neutrino flavor transformation and the associated processes associated with the energies there, like neutrino capture on nucleons or neutrino capture on nuclei to do heating, that's how you can affect the dynamics and nucleus synthesis of the supernova explosion. Likewise, and certainly that's the case in the active-active channel, we know that will happen. That's not speculative. We know that active-active flavor transformation happens. The issue is just where and how efficient it is in the supernova environment and what it does. Now, if there are active sterile transformations, if that's a possibility, then all hell breaks loose. And the simple model of the supernova that we'll run through can change dramatically, okay? Sometimes for the good, sometimes for the bad, okay? All channels of neutrino flavor conversion, both active-active and active-sterile, of course, affect the signal that we get. So let's just run through very quickly what a core collapse event is and sort of the basic, we'll just divide it up into three sort of general time frames. Massive stars, that is something greater than 10 solar masses, evolve in millions of years to the end point of their evolution. And the end point of their evolution is, here's the set, here's the from Weaver and Woolsey, 25 solar mass star, the core burning phases. These eventually become, of course, burning shells. This is the core burning phase. They spend most of their time on the main sequence of this particular star, about 7 million years. And you can see that there's a general increase in temperature and density from one burning phase to the next. And of course, you understand that's just because of the Coulomb barriers. Higher Coulomb barriers, got to have a higher temperature, etc. You'll notice here, however, that there's a fantastic acceleration in the burning time scale associated with core carbon and neon burning, carbon and oxygen burning, rather. And that's because at that point, neutrinos become dominant over photons in the energy loss mechanism from these stars. Okay? So by and by, the end point of evolution is to form an iron core, something like the size of the Earth. It's a white dwarf, an iron white dwarf with a mass about 1.5 solar masses. And that thing is heavy, though. It's not an ordinary white dwarf. It's iron peak material, the peak of the nuclear binding energy. And by a variety of means, general relativistic instability, for example, nuclear phase transitions, iron into alpha particles, this thing goes dynamically unstable. It collapses at almost a free fall rate. In of order 1 second, it gets the nuclear density, the nucleons touch, there's a fantastic increase in the pressure. Pressure goes over from being not very effective at all in halting things and dominated by relativistic particles to being dominated by non-relativistic and nucleon-nucleon interactions. And so there's a shockwave generated when this stuff just hits a brick wall. Okay, and that shockwave starts to move out. Now, during this collapse phase that lasts of order a second, when you collapse from something the size of the Earth to something the size of Santa Barbara, a hot neutron star, the material is extremely cold, and I'll talk about that in a second, with an entropy of order 1. This was the great insight that Hans Bethe provided in this problem. The shock is generated at the edge of the core. That shock moves out, and there's an entropy jump across the shock that's of order factor 10. So although the infalling material is very cold and well-ordered, and all the nucleons are in great big nuclei, when the shock passes through this material, it photodisintegrates all of that material, and that costs energy. And the central figure of merit of nuclear physics is that nucleons are bound inside nuclei by about 8 MeV. Okay? So when the shock traverses about a tenth of a solar mass of material, when it melts the nuclei in a tenth of a solar mass of material that it transits, it loses essentially all of its energy. So in short order, that shock becomes degraded, and instead of moving out, becomes a standing accretion shock. Now, it's been believed for about 17 years that on a time scale of some hundreds of milliseconds, a few tenths of a second, certainly by the epoch of order 1 second, that neutrino energy from inside the core leaks out, escapes from the core, and some very small fraction of it, of order 1%, is deposited behind the shock that increases the pressure behind the shock, that increases the Mach number of the shock moves out, gives you a supernova explosion. That's our great hope right now, that somehow this happens, okay? And subsequent speakers will talk in more detail about that. If by some chance, and somehow nature does it, you get an explosion, perhaps by this mechanism, then the explosion blows away all the material above the neutron star, and you're left with this hot neutron star, still full of neutrinos that are leaking out on diffusion timescales of order seconds. And that's where we think our best environment is, the best candidate environment for producing the heavy elements, for example. We'll call that the wind. Okay? There's this onion skin-like structure. This is from a Scientific American article by Weaver and Woolsey. It's a pretty picture. The advantages of PowerPoint. Okay. Right. So these massive stars are really giant refrigerators. That's the important thing to recognize about the infall epoch. Because the the entropy goes from something of order 10 units of Boltzmann's constant per baryon on the main sequence when it's burning hydrogen, that's like the entropy per baryon in the sun, something of that order, to a very cold entropy of order 1 at the onset of collapse. So that when the core of the supernova collapses, in some calculations it can be a frozen crystalline solid at a temperature of about an MeV. And so you have a gut feeling for what entropy means. It's a measure of disorder. So that if I have very high entropy conditions, if I had 6 free nucleons, 12 free nucleons, 6 neutrons and 6 protons, and then in a low entropy environment, I'd force all those things to move around as a unit. Okay, and that's the essential piece of physics, nuclear physics, associated with entropy and neutrinos here, is that high entropy means lots of free nucleons that are easily able to interact with neutrinos. Low entropy means nuclei where neutrinos are, where the energetics of the weak interaction are circumscribed in an interesting way and less vulnerable to neutrino interaction. So if I could give you a schematic view of a nucleus, here's a 10-cent version of a nucleus, spherical square well potential, 50 MeV deep. Imagine that I have non-interacting Fermi gases, degenerate Fermi gases at nearly zero temperature of protons and neutrons. The Fermi levels, just set by the saturation density of nuclear matter, are something of order 40 MeV. So again, this figure of merit that the typical binding energy of a nucleon in a nucleus is something like 8 or 10 MeV, something like that. The total entropy, of course, is an interesting quantity in the supernova. There's the sort of Maxwell-Boltzmann gas entropy expression that you're probably familiar with if you teach undergraduates. The entropy per unit volume of the nucleons in the Fermi gas inside nuclei, well, that goes something like temperature divided by this Fermi level. Remember, the temperature is of order 1 MeV, the Fermi level is of order 40 MeV, so that's a very small number. And if most of the stuff is in heavy nuclei, you can see that the entropy contributed there will be small. Likewise, the electrons are degenerate as well, relativistically degenerate, and their entropy is small. So that's how we get this very small entropy per baryon associated with collapse. So what happens during the infall epoch is that electron capture proceeds on protons that are inside nuclei for the most part. And eventually, this comes into equilibrium as the neutrino C becomes trapped in the core, and eventually these reverse reactions become comparable to the forward reactions. Then this goes into equilibrium. It can relate the chemical potentials of neutrons, protons, electrons, and electron neutrinos this way. And a figure of merit is that these electron neutrinos have the electrons have chemical potentials of order tens of MeVs. Remember, the temperature is of order only 1 MeV. Okay? Now, interestingly enough, that means that this system on infall is extremely sensitive to lepton number violating processes in the neutrino sector. So, for example, if we were to change electron neutrinos that are degenerate here into mu and tau neutrinos by some coherent process that's out of thermal equilibrium, then the system would be out of thermal equilibrium, and this would become unblocked, electron capture would go, entropy would be generated as we reapproach a new thermal equilibrium. Likewise, conversion of electron, now this is not likely to happen during the infall epoch because the density is very high, and we know that the neutrino masses are not such and their mass differences are not such to give this. But if there are sterile states that are appreciable in mass, then this could happen, and that gives entropy loss and or entropy generation. A kind of interesting figure of merit here is that the entropy per baryon produced by non-thermal processes like this is greater than about 3 units of Boltzmann's constant per baryon, then the nuclei would be melted, and we would not have this simple collapse picture to nuclear density. We get a thermal bounce instead. Electron capture heats nuclei. We don't have to go into that. So a figure of merit for infall is that if we had weak interaction processes that resulted in this, so mixing with sterile states, for example, that are heavy, then we would get something that looks nothing like what we see in nature. We would get something that looks truly bizarre, that would not look anything like the scenario I just outlined. Okay? If we ignore that and look at the standard picture, then neutrinos truly do dominate the energetics of collapse. The total energy in a supernova explosion that the astronomers see is like 10 to the 51 ergs. But again, the total energy in the neutrinos in the collapse, trapped in the core, is 100 times that. And so that figure of merit is that this is something like 10% of the star's rest mass. Okay, something like the gravitational binding energy drop in going from this white dwarf to a neutron star. And the neutrino diffusion timescale is something like seconds. And there's kind of equipartition of energy among all the different kinds of neutrinos once the collapse occurs. And so you can just take the gravitational binding energy, divide by six species of neutrinos, divide by a characteristic neutrino diffusion timescale, random walk time in the star, and you get a figure of merit of few times 10 to 51 Ergs per second for each of the six neutrino species. The energy spectra are, at least in broad brush, expected to be different, although they might not be very different. We don't know in detail. This is one objective of the major undertakings, the major numerical studies that are ongoing right now. But we would expect something crudely that looked like Fermi-Dirac blackbody spectra, where the electron neutrinos are the least energetic, the electron antineutrinos are next, and the mu and tau neutrinos are more energetic. And that's basically just because the electron neutrinos have a higher opacity via their charge current interactions, and so they decouple further out in the star where it's cooler. The mu and tau neutrinos have only neutral current opacity sources for the most part, and they decouple deeper in the star.
Okay. There will be study of Rafelden.
What's that?
Rafelden.
Yeah, so I'm saying we don't know. Yes, and there are many papers, and they're all in disagreement about what the energy spectra look like. Okay, so this is just a guide to the eye. I'm saying we don't know what these look like. Okay, this is one reason why we would like to know more about the supernova neutrino signal, for example. We could answer these questions, at least for some times. Now, if the explosion is, the shock fails to explode the star, and we're certain, just on basic nuclear physics grounds, that it will, the initial prompt shock will fail, then how do we re-energize it? And the key to this was this paper by Beta and Wilson in 18 years ago now, that it's neutrino charge current capture on free nucleons that provides most of the heating behind the shock. And so here's kind of a cartoon by these processes. If we have the shock out at something like a few hundred kilometers to 500 kilometers, this is based on Jim Wilson's numbers, so everything is extremely optimistic. And in more recent calculations, it's more like 200 kilometers. And the idea would be that you would, you know, something like 1% of that neutrino energy would be captured behind the shock and cause a supernova explosion. Now, this figure is designed to show you that if you had higher energy mu and tau neutrinos, if you could convert those to electron neutrinos, you might have some leverage on the shock, and I'll show you what that can do. Okay, so let's say that by hook or by crook, you get a shock to go. Okay, so this is a calculation done by Richard Schirato, a former student, and I, based on some of Jim Wilson's calculations and others, what you would expect if you actually got a viable shock. And so what you saw there is on a time scale of something of order 10 seconds, this shock propagates out quite a ways, the shock radius in centimeters. And so what you saw was the creation of a rarefaction zone behind the shock. This is the so-called hot bubble region, which remains our best candidate site for the production of the R process, which Yang Chen will talk about in a little bit. The R process, that's the rapid neutron capture process. We know it happens somewhere. We've known that for over 40 years. Question is where? Okay. There are a number of ideas for where it might occur. Neutrino-heated supernova ejecta from that hot bubble region is probably our best candidate, our best suspect right now. And the pros are, as perhaps Chen will talk about, for instance, these guys show that we might see the neutrino fingerprints of neutrino nucleus interactions on the observed fossil record, our process abundances now. There's a happy coincidence between meteoritic and chemical evolution timescales and some interesting things that Chen, I think, will show us. And the cons are that it's kind of live by the sword, die by the sword, as I'll show you. If you have a sufficient neutrino flux to eject this stuff from the star, then you also have problems because of the interestingly high entropy in that, not low entropy, but high entropy in that bubble. Okay? Compact object mergers, neutron star mergers, they have the advantage they have lots of neutrons, but they don't do very, they have a major problem, in my view, with R process production timescales and mass ejection. And there are other scenarios for making this thing work, very high entropy and fast outflow rates that evade the alpha effect problems that a number of people have looked at, especially nice work recently by Todd Thompson. Okay? I think Chen will talk about this more. So if I could just show you the kind of quick and dirty cartoon of what the what the hot bubble environment might look like and what the scenario for neutrino-heated R-process nuclear synthesis would be, it would be something like this. Here's the hot neutron star. The neutrinos are diffusing. They stream off the surface, more or less freely stream out here. But then this is a very low density environment that's heated by these processes to high entropy. So whereas the entropy inside the collapsing core was of order 1, this entropy out here is of order 100, which is a very, very large entropy. And also, it's the competition of these two reactions that set the neutron to proton ratio. So you can see that if the Nui bars are more energetic than the Nui's, as we expect in kind of the zero order model, there should be more neutrons than protons. And that's why this is an interesting regime, interesting environment, perhaps, for making the R process. That cartoon should be reminiscent, or could be reminiscent to you, of the history of the early universe, and indeed it is. In fact, if I draw a sequence of causal horizon scales, particle horizon scales in the early universe, then effectively the QCD horizon, when the temperature is 100 MeV, well, that's nuclear density, essentially. It's interesting enough that's about 10 kilometers across, and the total mass energy, mostly relativistic particles, inside this thing is about a solar mass. So the QCD horizon is an ultra-high entropy neutron star. And remember that in the Big Bang, the history is at a somewhat later epoch. The neutrinos cease scattering and exchanging energy with the environment. That's weak decoupling. And at a later epoch, the neutrons and protons, which are flipping back and forth, their isospin is flipping by these reactions. Well, these reactions fall below the local material expansion rate of the universe, and the neutron-to-proton ratio at that point is frozen in. Same thing happens in the supernova environment. Okay, and at an even later epoch, alpha particles form. So if I could show you a cartoon of that, then here's what Big Bang nucleosynthesis looks like if you ride along with a little piece of the universe. It doesn't matter which piece because of homogeneity and isotropy. And here's what the neutrino-driven R process would look like, much the same. In fact, these two things are essentially identical. On a nuclear physics scale, the entropy is huge, and it's about the same. 10 to the 10 here, 100 here. That's about the same on a nuclear physics scale. The difference is that these are isospin mirrors of one another. There are more protons than neutrons here. There are more neutrons than protons here. So that when you make the alpha particles here, you scour out all the neutrons. And that's essentially the end of the line. When you make alpha particles here, you scour out all the protons. And you leave this sea of neutrons. And that's why here, the neutrons can survive and capture on iron seed nuclei, very tiny few of those, and make uranium. That's the basic idea. Now, the key to this is that the entropy is high. Okay? And so if you think about nuclei in equilibrium at high temperature, then, of course, it's a fight between the entropy condition, which doesn't want you to have very many heavy nuclei if the entropy is high, right? And the binding energy in the nucleus. So the nucleus which satisfies that fight, that sits right in the middle, is the alpha particle. A heavier nucleus would not be very abundant because of the huge thermodynamic price at high entropy that you pay for that. Although it would win a little bit in binding energy. And likewise, a lighter nucleus than an alpha particle would not have enough binding energy to make up for this. So alpha particles are what you get, and that's the key here. Okay? The problem with that is that also, remember that we want to eject this stuff out into the environment, and so we want a big neutrino flux. And remember that a nucleon is bound gravitationally, this is the gravitational binding energy of a nucleon near the surface of the neutron star, it's about 100 MeV. The typical energy of neutrinos is about 10 MeV. So we need neutrino fluxes big enough that every nucleon, on average, interacts something like 10 times with neutrinos or antineutrinos in order that we eject this stuff into space. But when you incorporate all the nucleons into alpha particles, you leave these neutrons sitting out in the breeze, and these neutrons can capture an electron neutrino and turn into a proton. That finds another neutron, and every weak interaction then takes out two neutrons, and in short order, you don't have the neutrons to make uranium. Okay? That's the basic problem. So let me turn now to what neutrino mixing can do. Okay, so you know what the situation is here. Everybody knows this. I'm not going to say any more about it. If we ignore the LSD experiment, we have this nice picture. We essentially know everything except theta 1, 3. in CP violating phase. Mini-Boon, as was talked about in the previous talk, will answer the question. It explores some interesting, astrophysically interesting parameter space well beyond that, actually, that LS&D probed. Okay? And if LS&D turns out to have been right, then we have to introduce a fourth neutrino. And neither one of these schemes fits very well. Perhaps Tom will or other people will tell us about this, but neither one fits very well. This one, of course, is greatly disfavored now because of Camlan. This one doesn't fit very well either. Nevertheless, we can take a look at what this does. Here's kind of a partial bibliography of half the people in this room have written papers on what neutrino mixing does in supernovae. So let's take a couple different cases. Let's take them in order. Let's talk about coherent neutrino flavor evolution above the neutron star, above the neutrino sphere to begin with. Okay? So obviously we want to look at effective mass contributions from neutrino forward scattering on electrons and also on other neutrinos. So we have the same kind of neutrino effective mass term that we do in the sun, for example, neutrino electron forward scattering, charge current exchange. But in the supernova environment, if you take a little cubic centimeter of material above the neutron star, there may be orders of magnitude more neutrinos flying through that little cubic centimeter at some instant in time than there are electrons. So the neutral current analog in the previous process, neutral current forward exchange scattering, can become important. And of course, the neutral current exchange on neutrinos has the opposite amplitude from scattering on antineutrinos. So it really is the difference between neutrinos and antineutrinos that matters. Now, let me just show you, remind you what the basic physics of this is, okay? It's kind of a semi-classical hand-waving baloney version of MSW, okay? Just to illustrate a point. Let's just take a toy problem of neutrino electrons forward scattering, okay? I could write down the Lagrangian for that. Okay, there's a free piece. There's the piece for the neutrino. There's the piece for the electron. And here's the current-current Lagrangian interaction between them. So let's just define this kind of weird potential now. Okay, and it'll have a time-like piece and a space-like piece. All right, essentially just the electron current with a 1 minus gamma 5 in it. Then I can write this interaction Hamiltonian for the neutrino this way, and then from that you can easily see that I can get the usual kind of Dirac equation, okay? And from that Dirac equation, I can Fourier transform it and get a dispersion relation, okay? So there's the energy of the neutrino. Notice the time-like piece of the potential comes in here, and the space-like piece comes in here. So I can expand this and write it this way, and then we'd say here's the vacuum mass of the neutrino. Here's an effective mass contribution from forward scattering with the time-like piece of the potential. Here's an effective mass contribution with the space-like piece of the potential. And here are second-order processes, okay? Well, it's that piece with the time-like potential that we know and love for MSW in the sun or in the Earth, for example. This one we ignore because it goes like G Fermi squared and it's small. This is the interesting one because it's a scalar product of vectors. Okay, so there's a directionality associated with that one. Okay, and so these brackets mean that we have to average or take an ensemble average somehow over the neutrinos that are there or the electrons that are there. So if there were, this term would vanish if I just average over an isotropic distribution of electrons. If we have a current of electrons, however, it will not vanish. Obviously, in the supernova environment, the neutrino-neutrino forward scattering is not isotropic. And so that term can become very important. Okay, so to look at neutrino flavor transformation there, this term with electron scattering is pretty easy to follow, but this B potential with the neutrinos is not so easy to follow. And in addition, there's a flavor off diagonal term as well that doesn't happen for the pure electron-driven case at all. Okay, and so we can solve a Schrödinger equation, a Schrödinger-like equation for that, that looks like a more or less innocent addition to MSW. In fact, it's not so innocent. And one of the reasons is the following. And this is from a paper by Chen and I from a number of years ago, about 10 years ago now. And the point is, if we wanted to know, we were following this neutrino right here with this energy E sub R, and it had a resonance, an MSW resonance here, that was based on neutrinos flying through this position. then we would need to know the flavor history of this neutrino. We need to know the flavor of it. In turn, then, we need to know the flavor evolution history of that background neutrino. And it may have gone through another resonance deeper in here. And so, not only does it depend on the angle of the neutrino, as I just showed you from the simple, you know, structure of the weak current, it also depends in a complicated and nonlinear way on the evolution history of the neutrinos. Okay? So it's just nonlinear. Okay? It depends on the entropy in an interesting way. Here's a calculation from Walter Landry, looking at, I think, Yon Chen and his student have done similar kinds of calculations. And Pastor and Raffelt have done similar kind of calculations where we look at electron survival probability and distance from the star. It's very complicated because of the nonlinearities involved. It's not easy to follow neutrino flavor transformation at all. Okay? What's that?
It looks like abstract painting.
Yes. It's yes, we can sell it maybe. I don't know. Okay. So nevertheless, even with just three active neutrinos and just the atmospheric delta M squared scale, there's a lot of interesting things that can happen as a result of matter-enhanced neutrino flavor transformation. For example, in the neutrino process, if we had a hotter spectrum of electron neutrinos, secondary to flavor transformation of high-energy mu and tau neutrinos into electron neutrinos, then that can affect that process in an interesting way. Neutrino capture-induced fission, I think Yang will talk about this some more. The fission cross-sections can be very large if the electron neutrinos have a high energy. Okay? That, in turn, can affect, essentially they're large because we take advantage of nuclear coherence in an interesting way. That can affect the R process in interesting ways. Okay? What about active sterile transformation? I told you all bets were off. In some cases, it can do some good. If we can get rid of the sterile neutrinos, Baha Balantekin, Gail McLaughlin, and coworkers have looked at this, also Patel, also David Caldwell, Chen. It does interesting things. We can get the electron fright, we can cure that alpha effect problem by making the electron neutrinos go away at the right place and also get the electron fraction very, very low, very neutron rich. And that, in turn, can easily overcome many problems with the R process. It might even have interesting nucleosynthetic signatures. Contrary to popular belief, active sterile conversion in the core need not be fatal to getting a supernova explosion. Remember, the point here is the explosion energy is only 1% of the neutrino energy in the core. And we don't really know how the explosion comes about. So for all we know, we could throw away 80% of the energy and still have more than enough to make an explosion. You might ask, if there's one light sterile, are there other light steriles? And I think Kev Abizagian and others will probably talk about cosmological implications for heavier sterile neutrinos. Suffice it to say here that they could give you conversion in the core of the supernova and cause all kinds of interesting problems. Okay? And to look at what happens in the core, we need to look at a different channel, not coherence production of active to sterile conversion, but rather sterile production through matter-suppressed and matter-enhanced decoherence. I don't really want to talk about this very much because I think Kev will talk about it for the early universe. Suffice it to say that we have to modify the way neutrino transport is treated in the core in the limit where now the neutrino mean free path is small or of order the resonance width in the MSW resonance. That's a difficult problem to treat. It hasn't been incorporated in the core in any reasonable sense that, okay, systematic way anyway. So if I try to summarize all of the kind of neutrino mixing physics that could affect all these things I talked about, okay, here it is. Here is square root of delta M squared on this axis running from about a microvolt to 100 kilovolts and log of sine squared 2 theta vacuum. And so anything in this blue crosshatch region, and this is from a review that Kev and I are writing, anything in this blue crosshatch region, either in the active-active channel down here or in the active-sterile channel throughout the whole region, would affect the energetics of the supernova explosion. Likewise, anything in this red crosshatch region, any mixing parameters that nature chooses in here, would affect that model for neutrino-heated ejecta R process. Okay? And then there's conversion in the envelope we'll get to in a second. The point, what I want you to come away with from this is the following. Here's the observational data. There's the LS&D banana, for example. There is the atmospheric neutrino region right there. Here is the LMA region for the Sun. The point is that the supernova environment is far more sensitive to neutrino mixing than likely any laboratory experiment will ever do. That's the good news. The bad news, of course, is we don't really understand a lot about supernovae, and we don't really have, at this point, you know, adequate measures of things like the R process and supernova neutrino signal. But it is interesting nevertheless. And there may be a lot of interesting physics that might show up when we do understand supernovae that we can't access in a laboratory. Okay? And finally, let me conclude by saying a few things. How much time have I got? What's that?
10 minutes.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right, we'll try to wrap it up quickly. Let's turn then to this thing I just showed you. You know, down here is the envelope, and something like this will affect the envelope. In fact, the supernova neutrino signal might be affected by any parameters in here. Okay? So what about the neutrino burst signal? What detectors do we have that could detect supernova neutrinos? Super K, big water Cherenkov detectors, the descendants of those, perhaps something like UNO or Hyper-K, Subray Neutrino Observatory, perhaps neutral current-based detectors like Omnis, for example, that Dave Caldwell, I think, will say something about. There's one overall figure of merit that has to be remembered, though, which has never made me a big fan of supernova neutrino detection. It's that the supernova rate is something like once per 30 years in the galaxy. Okay, and so it's wonderful if we can catch one of these things, and the physics payoff would be huge, as I'll show you. But we got to wonder, are these detectors going to be around? Indeed, we can ask if any of us are going to be around, but, you know, are these detectors going to be around? It's an issue. And the physics payoff might be big enough that we have to grapple with this question and actually try to make sure that there are detectors like this that are around for long enough to see one of these things in the galaxy. Now, the attraction of looking for the supernova neutrino signal is the following. You know, in the Sun, we're limited to a rather small range and density, and just by chance or whatever, we've been lucky that that density and the neutrino energies correspond to resonances. Okay? So we can see something, or at least matter effects are evident there. Okay? And by contrast, there's a fantastic run of density over many, many orders of magnitude, many more orders of magnitude than in the Sun. So if there's any kind of mixing physics at almost any mass scale, we could potentially see it. And so a number of people have looked at this and tried to exploit that. Now, recently, Richard Chirato and I realized there's even a very interesting thing that can happen. If there actually is a shock, then that can give you some characteristic signals that allow even more precise estimates of what's going on with the neutrino physics. And I think Cecilia Lunardini, who's also and Alexei Smirnov, who's worked on this, so also I think Cecilia will talk about this in somewhat more detail. Here's the basic idea that was in Richard Chirato's thesis, that if you have, say, two resonance positions, let's say putatively, just as take this scheme, a mu neutrino changes to a steril here, there's a resonance, and down here there's an electron neutrino to a mu neutrino. An active steril here, active there, two resonances. And here comes the shock. Now, as the shock goes through that, you saw that there's quite an excursion in density. It shuts off one resonance, goes through, turns back that resonance, turns it back on, and goes to the second resonance position and shuts that one off, and then moves on further, and they're both turned on again. Okay, so let's see if this works. So here's for example, density versus radius. It's hard to read this. This is again from Richard's thesis. This is density here. And here is sine squared 2 theta matter. This is the effective matter mixing. Okay, and you can see, let's have an active steril scheme here, the 3+1 scheme, for example. And we'll have three resonances then. One at the solar delta M squared scale, one at the atmospheric delta M squared scale, and one at the splitting the Ellison D scale. Okay, all right. So here they are, three resonances, and here are the effective matter mixing angles associated with those. Green is the solar, purple is the atmospheric, and blue is the Ellison D. Okay. So now, as the shock moves out and that rarefaction zone digs in, you can see that We'll get three level crossings here, four level crossings, okay? And then as we go to the solar now, solar has three, four, in fact that was an avoided level crossing right there. Very rich, very, very rich. So could you see any of this? In fact, we could look at the corresponding energy spectra. Here's three active neutrinos. Here's a 3 plus 1 is purple, 2 plus 2 is blue. So you could look at that cartoon and see that there, as the shock moves through these various resonance regions, there's all kinds of interesting stuff going on in energy. Okay. So what does this look like? Well, if we plot charge current ratios, okay, and neutral current ratios, then we might see the following, for example. In the three active neutrinos only, that's just red, then as the shock comes through, this is time post-bounce, as the shock comes through that through the resonance region for the atmospheric delta M squared scale and then the solar delta M squared scale, you see this excursion, which we might be able to pick up. In fact, the amplitude of that excursion is proportional to sine squared 2 theta 1 3. So this might be a way we can measure that, for example. Okay. And likewise, if we look at same kinds of things here, if instead of having simply straight MSW, we took into account the fact, or tried to take into account the fact that this is a turbulent environment, perhaps, and a rather complicated environment behind the shock, as Ray Sawyer has pointed out, then we could have flavor depolarization if there were adiabatic transitions through MSW resonances, and you would still see these things. Okay. So the conclusions. So I still think core collapse events represent the ultimate neutrino physics, quote-unquote, laboratories, okay? If only we could decipher the nucleosynthesis fossil record and or capture a detailed neutrino burst signal, we'd be in business, okay? But we're not there yet. So I would say this, a better understanding of neutrino mass and mixing physics might certainly shed some light on what's going on with the R process, and it might even help us understand where supernova explosions come from. Just possibly it might work the other way, too. Don't know that. Okay? But it certainly will work this way. If we can catch the neutrino burst from a galactic core collapse event, both in the neutral current and charge current channels, and it's important to get both. Okay? It's very important to get both. And we can do so with good statistics, and we can do so over the whole range of interest here that I talked about today. So that range is over some 10 seconds. Many times when people tell you about neutrino bursts, detecting a neutrino burst, they're really talking about that shock reheating epoch, which is only of order 1 second. That's when the luminosities are high. We really need big enough detectors that we can go late so that we can probe that physics, that neutrino mixing physics, that might develop when that rarefaction zone behind the shock digs in and where the R process is made. Okay? So if we can do that, that's going to help ameliorate a lot of the astrophysics uncertainties, which really completely hamstrung our efforts to extract real neutrino information from the 87A signal. Okay? And I think it will help us, it will get us, you know, it will certainly tell us something about supernovae. Might even tell us where the explosion comes from, and it might even tell us key elements of weak interaction physics, like theta 1-3, that we might be hard-pressed to measure in a laboratory, or might give us at least a complementary measurement. Thanks.
We have time for a few questions.
To the best of your knowledge right now, do you need the extra parameters of a sterile neutrino to make the R process work?
Well, look, you know, $1.50 and an R process saving model will get you a cup of coffee, okay? There are a number of different ways we can do it. Certainly, if you let me play with neutrino physics, then active sterile neutrino mixing will produce an R process and a nice R process, okay?
I'm asking the other way.
Hang on, let me finish. And in fact, it's interesting, when we play that game, the parameters could be those of the LS&D, could be coincident with the LS&D parameters. I don't know what that means. It's suggested. There are other things, like, for example, general relativistic effects, which we've also looked at, which engender very fast outflows in the wind. And those can also reproduce the R process. I don't like those as well because the authors involved, like Christian Carnall, would probably disagree with me. But I actually think I don't like those as much because I think they're very finely tuned. Okay? And look, it's hard for me to understand how something as relativistic as a neutron star core with a radius of order 3m is gonna survive long enough to get a fair amount of dark process material out. So right now, I think, in my mind, the most robust way to get the R process that's out there in the literature is active sterile neutrino mixing. Does that prove anything? No, I don't think so. Okay, not at this point. That's just my view.
Okay. So active-active fails.
Active-active does not give a robust solution the way active sterile does. Okay, active-active can help you in a number of ways, mostly associated with neutrino processes like neutrino capture on heavy nuclei and fission associated with that, and a number of other things as well. It can change the electron fraction a little bit, but nothing dramatic. It's not a home run. Okay, that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. It doesn't help. Okay.
Let's thank George once again.